The Boy, Stirling Moss, A Life in 60 Laps. In The Boy, Richard Williams assesses what made Stirling Moss such an iconic figure. He builds a fascinating and revealing portrait of a driver who was a hero to millions. If you know how much I love my motor racing and my motor racing interviews, I have been looking forward to speaking to Richard for about 3 weeks now. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, Richard Williams himself. Richard, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Giles. Nice to be with you.
Great to be with you again. Congratulations on the book. I'll start off by saying I got halfway through it. It's a brilliant read, and I liked it so much that it's so popular that when my father came around this afternoon to meet me, he stole it from me.
Wonderful. We'll have to send you another one. It was funny to hear Love Me Do just then and to realise that that was released a few months after the end of Stirling's professional career, which makes it seem like a very, very long time ago.
Yeah, isn't it just? I was listening to something about Gagarin going into space in what was it, 60 years ago, and you think around about that time. And yet, if you say to somebody, who do you think you are, if they're driving too quickly, Stirling Moss, 9 times out of 10, people will know exactly who you're speaking about.
Yes, yes, no, and nobody would say, who do you think you are, Nigel Mansell, or or even who do you think you are, Lewis Hamilton?
Well, I mean, they could do, but that's an entirely different conversation, I might think. So, I mean, Stirling was taking from us, Sir Stirling, excuse me, but we'll call him Stirling from here on, I think, in the midst of a pandemic. But even then, it made headlines, and considering that he hadn't raced competitively, really, for 60 years, it just goes to show what an icon, what an impact he made. It wasn't just about the sport, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was about Britain in the years after the war, in a way, when the country was recovering from everything it had been through, and it was looking for heroes, and sporting heroes in particular, I think, after the war. And, you know, it had a couple in Dennis Compton, the great cricketer, and Stanley Matthews, the great footballer, but they'd started their careers before the war, so they were already known, and they were able to resume in 1945 and come back and, you know, become even bigger heroes. But the thing about Stirling, who started racing in 1947 when he was 18, is that he was a completely fresh face. He was completely new, and he, I think, exemplified a sort of a sense of optimism, you know, that something new was coming out of these terrible years of the war.
And also, if you look at his rise through the ranks, as it were, if you think about, because motor racing in Great Britain, at least on the mainland, it hadn't really taken off. I mean, but motor races were continental European affairs, you know, massive road races between, you know, across the Low Countries, or of course, more famously in Italy with the Targa Florio and the Mia Miglia. So it wasn't until after the war that Britain got a hold of the racing bug.
Yes, that's right. And it was largely thanks to the fact that there were all these disused aerodromes lying around England that had been used, you know, for bombers and fighters throughout the war. But then when the war was over, there they were. And they were ideal for young chaps who wanted to build their own racing cars to use for competition. So suddenly, from having been really almost nowhere in terms of international motorsport, Britain had a very flourishing scene. And out of that, of course, came lots of different makes of cars like Cooper and Lotus and BRM and Van Wall, and later on McLaren and Brabham and so on, but also a whole generation of drivers of which Stirling was the leader.
And if you look at that, I mean, if you look at how he came up, I mean, he started driving around his father's farm, didn't he, in the southeast of England. But he was immediately winning things, if you like, you know, hill climbs, sprints, reversing in endurance tests before he even got into, if you like, a proper car. And then as soon as he got into sort of the 500s, he was winning left, right, and centre.
Yes. Well, he came from a very competitive family. His dad, who was actually a dentist and ran a business of dental surgeries in the south of England, his dad had raced at Brooklands and at Indianapolis, actually, before the war. His mother was a very keen horsewoman, very competitive, who also drove in hill climbs and trials. So there was, and then Stirling's sister, Pat, was a very keen show jumper, as Sterling was when he was very young. So, you know, there was a lot of encouragement to do this. His dad, when Sterling was very young, bought an old Austin 7 and turned it into a kind of runabout for the farm to carry hay bales around in. And Sterling learned to drive on that. And of course, you know, with your own farm to drive on, you can, you know, you can, it's not like driving on the public roads. You can do whatever you want. So he learned how to slide a car and, you know, how to handle things, you know, at a very, very early age indeed.
Did he burn his stomach or something on a trip to Brooklands or get too close to a car? And that's what he put down the reason that he could withstand, because motor racing, although people say, oh, they just sit in a car and the car goes all the work, it's an intensely physical business now, and it was an intensely physical business back in the 40s and 50s.
Yes, it was very, very physical indeed. Yeah, when he was five, in the mid-30s, his dad took him on his first lap of Brooklands, and then a year later, when he was six, he was at Brooklands again, and he was leaning over a car to look in the cockpit, and he burned his tummy on the hot exhaust pipe, and he always said that gave him his lifelong high threshold of pain, because he was legendary for recovering from horrible accidents very, very quickly and getting back into the cockpit and into races again.
And he was at the first, was it the first British Grand Prix proper, which I thought was, is it the 1950 British Grand Prix he's at when he's introduced to the then King George the VI, because he's in one of the supporting races in the 500s.
That's right. That meeting was known as Royal Silverstone, because the King and the Queen, that would be George the VI and Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, as we came to know her, and Princess Margaret actually also turned up to watch the inaugural Grand Prix of the FIA World Championship. It was the first World Championship race, and Sterling was taking part in the support race, the 500cc race, and the main drivers were lined up and presented to the royal family, and Sterling was one of them, along with Farina and Ascari and the great continental drivers. So he was already, you know, at very, very young age, beginning to breathe the same air as them.
And also, he got his, if you like, his first break into Formula One. Was it with a British team alongside Lance Macklin? Was it the, and forgive me because it slipped my memory, was it the HWM? Yeah, HWM, sorry.
Which stood for Hersham and Walton Motors, which was a garage not far away from where I am, in Twickenham. And they built their own cars, 2-litre cars in those days, which were, to begin with, were Formula 2 cars, and then became Grand Prix cars. And yes, he got serious continental experience going around the Grand Prix circuit racing with them.
I mean, we talk about the races then, but the whole, you know, you think of your modern Grand Prix racing driver, and he gets in, or your Grand Prix motor racing meeting, you know, there are three races, the drivers go in one race and that's it. But of course, back in the 50s, it's an entirely different atmosphere, and drivers could be driving literally every weekend in various classes, in various sports, and on the same day could be competing almost like jockeys in four or five events.
Yeah, absolutely, but in completely different kinds of cars. So Sterling might very easily race in five different races in a day, in a 500cc car, a Formula One car, a small sports car, a large sports car, and a saloon car. All on the same day. I mean, they'd be short races, most of them. But even so, you know, it required leaping out of one kind of car and into a completely different sort, and you'd have to practice and qualify in all of them as well. And I mean, the reason he did that was partly because he liked driving racing cars, any kind of racing car, but also he treated it as a business. And each race you took part in, you got starting money for, and if you were the more famous you were, and the better your car was, the more starting money you got paid, and also you picked up prize money as well. So, you know, once or twice he won five races in a day. I'm thinking of a day at Brands Hatch, for instance. So, you know, you pick up five lots of starting money and five lots of prize money.
It's an interesting one, isn't it, though? Because, you know, now we live in an era of professional sportsmen, and you look back and you think, oh, well, in the 50s it was all halcyon days and it was the, you know, the great Corinthians. But having read the book, I was struck by how professionally Sterling took his driving, and something came back to me, because he would race and they drove through Europe in the early days, certainly you know, to save money. But you know, he certainly took it professionally. When he, and you think about, you know, I saw this movie, which was Ferrari, A Drive to Immortality, A Race to Immortality, which you may be familiar with. Yeah. And it's all about the '50s, and it's about, a lot of it is about, you know, Peter Collins and Mike Hawthorne. And you think about how they had that sort of champagne Charlie image. Well, Sterling had an image, but underneath that, he was, you know, 100% professional.
Oh, yes. I think he managed to straddle the two kinds of culture very effectively. And in a way, that's what made him so popular. I think that he was really professional. People could see he took it seriously. He was a virtuoso. You know, he was as skillful as anybody who ever raced a car. But he also, you know, he made it seem like fun. He had a terrific image. You know, he had this white helmet, which was very recognizable, plain white helmet. He had a very relaxed style at the wheel, even when he was going, you know, hell for leather, 10/10, as he'd put it. You know, there was something very attractive about the way he drove a car. And, you know, these things put together were what made him such a hero. But he was intensely professional, you know. I mean, in his, you know, the majority of his career, I mean, he was a man who was very keen on girls, but he abstained from sex for several days before a race, you know, which was pretty tough going if you were racing 30 or 40 weekends a year. And, you know, he'd always go for the cheaper hotel if he had the option. And as you say, you know, he'd drive across Europe rather than spending money on flights and so on. So, you know, he looked at the details all the time of his career. And he wrote everything down as well in diaries, which he kept, and which have turned out to be very useful to historians.
And also he had a brush with you know, the old man himself, Ferrari, you know, in the early days. I wasn't aware of this, and he drove all the way to, was it Bari, I believe, to have a meeting with him?
Yeah, well, he drove to Modena, where the Ferrari family is, to have a meeting with in his Morris Minor, which I think caused Enzo Ferrari to raise his eyebrow a bit. Yes, it was a very fateful meeting, really. This was in 1951, when Sterling was 21, 22, and had already established his reputation as, you know, the up-and-coming young star. And Ferrari offered him a drive in his Grand Prix cars, which was a terrific honor, because they were obviously, you know, as good as it got at the time, in two races at the British Grand Prix and the French Grand Prix. And Sterling was very patriotic, and he was down to drive in the French Grand Prix, which came first of the two, for the HWM team. And he said to Ferrari, well, I'm terribly sorry, I can't race in that one because I'm committed to my British team, but I will race in the British Grand Prix for you. And Ferrari said, no, that's no good, I want a driver for two races or none. So Sterling said, okay, well, I've got to stick with my commitment. Ferrari gave the drive to an Argentinian called Jose Froilan Gonzalez, went and won the British Grand Prix at Silverstone, which was a very historic victory. And that, you know, you'd have to think could have been Sterling's win. And that would have accelerated his career a lot. But anyway, Ferrari offered him another drive in Bari and said, okay, turn up at Bari and we'll have a car for you. So Sterling and his dad, who often traveled with him, took a flight to somewhere, I can't remember where exactly, in Italy, and then had a very uncomfortable train journey down to Bari in Puglia, halfway down the right-hand side of Italy. And when they got there, they went to the garage where the Ferrari team had set up and found the car that Sterling thought he was going to drive. And he was about to get in the cockpit to see if it fitted. And the mechanic said, no, you can't get in that. That's not yours. And Moss said, well, yeah, it's my car. And the mechanic said, no, it's been promised to Piero Taruffi, who was a much more experienced Italian driver. And so there was no car for Sterling, having gone all the way down from London to Bari. And he was furious. And there was no real explanation from Ferrari. And he swore that at that moment that he would never drive for Ferrari. And in so doing, probably did himself out of a couple of world championships. Because if he joined the team then, you know, they had a few very good years.
It's an interesting, wasn't it? Because there's always been this, because he never was world champion. And I remember when Mansell was close to almost not getting the world championships, when Stirling was saying, well, I hope to be the greatest British driver only to never won the world championship, so I hope Nigel wins it. But if you think about it, I mean, there's always been this great thing that had he gone to, if he'd not wanted to race, I mean, he won in Vanwall, but he got involved with BRM, who you aren't exactly singing the praises of in the book, saying they were always, just a little bit late, to put it mildly. And he thought that the BRM was frankly dangerous at one point. But if he'd gone to, a foreign team perhaps earlier, he would have won more world championships. Though he did go to Mercedes, of course.
He did, but he went to Mercedes as Fangio's number two.
Yeah.
And Fangio was already a world champion. He was on his way to five world championships. And he was the sort of, he was the number one in Grand Prix racing at the time. And Stirling went to Mercedes knowing that he would be the number two, and accepting that. Because in those days, that's the way it went. You know, nowadays, in a Formula One team, the two drivers in a team are expected to fight each other first before they fight anybody else. Wasn't the same in the 50s and 60s. If you were the number two, then you deferred to the number one. But Stirling knew that year that he could spend a year following in Fangio's wheel tracks and learning a great deal, from the man who was the greatest of them all at the time. And that's what happened. And of course, he did win a Grand Prix at Aintree, his first win in a Mercedes ahead of Fangio. And that was a great thing for him and a historic thing. But he was, it's a fact, he was runner-up that season for the first time. He went on to be runner-up in the championship four times and third three times, I think. And no doubt, if he'd made some different decisions, he would have won several world championships. But we do remember him, one of the reasons we remember him is that, he was certainly the greatest driver never to win the title.
Also, I mean, we're talking F1, but you can't not remember the brilliant sports car drives he pulled off.
Absolutely.
1955, Emilia Miglia is an iconic victory. It's himself and Dennis Jenkinson as his co-pilot. And this is a race that would claim the life of Deportego 2 years later in a horrendous crash that basically put an end to a lot of the road racing around the world. And in 55, of course, we had the Le Mans disaster as well. So, I mean, 1955, his victory in that race was quite something.
Yes, and the Mille Miglia was a race of 1,000 miles on public roads round the northern half of Italy. It started and finished in Brescia, and it went sort of down the Adriatic coast, then across the middle through the mountains, across to Rome, and then back up through Florence and Siena, Tuscany, and back to Brescia. And of course, you can't really close 1,000 miles of public road very effectively. So, they were driving, Moss would have been driving the Mercedes, which was more or less a disguised Formula One car with a sports car body on it, if you like, and driving at, Formula One speeds, really. But you never really knew what was going to be around the next corner. Could be a herd of sheep or a closed level crossing. But he did it in just over 10 hours at an average speed of just under 100 miles an hour, which was extraordinary. I've got that average a bit wrong. I've exaggerated that a bit. But he did it in 10 hours. And an amazing speed, top speeds of 130, 140 miles an hour on public roads, with no motorways in those days. So we're talking essentially two-lane roads. The secret of that victory was to have done several reconnaissance laps with his navigator, Dennis Jenkinson, who was a journalist, who made copious notes and entered them all on a roll of paper many, 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 many feet long, and rolled them up like a roll of lavatory paper and put it in a box with a little perspex window and a roller handle on it, and just rolled it around as they were going along. And he gave Moss instructions by hand signals, so we've got a hairpin bend coming up or a fast right-hander or, there's a humpback bridge ahead. And Moss had to trust him implicitly because of the speeds they were going, but it certainly worked.
And then, of course, there's the iconic victory in 61. At Monaco, the most glamorous Grand Prix of them all, where he takes on the Ferraris that he might be driving the next year. And you know, in a privateer, Lotus, takes victory in the Principality.
Yes, well, 1961 really was a Ferrari year. They had a much better car than anybody else. They had a V6 engine, much more powerful. They had good drivers. Moss was in a privately entered, obsolete four-cylinder Lotus. But at Monaco, of course, which is a very twisty, tight circuit, it's a good opportunity for the virtuosity of a top driver to express itself. And, you know, Monaco was a perfect stage for Moss. And he got ahead of the Ferraris, three of them pursuing him. You know, it was like a dogfight between fighter jets, three of these red cars pursuing his blue car. And through sheer skill and driving at 10 tenths, as he put it, all the way through the race, you know, he managed to stay ahead and win what he thought he believed to be his greatest victory.
And again, it's the getting back to an adoring British press, because, or an adoring British public, because we, there were comics, you know, it was a boy's own adventure, wasn't it, Sterling? I mean, the book is called The Boy, but it really was the sort of stuff that, because motor racing at that point in the 50s and perhaps the early 60s was an intensely patriotic affair.
Yes, and he was a very patriotic man. And, you know, early on in his career, you know, it cost him a bit when he decided that he'd drive British cars in order to win Grand Prix, and there simply weren't British cars good enough. So he wasted a couple of important years of his career driving no-hopers in Formula One races. But, you know, that endeared him to the public, and they understood when he decided he had to drive a Mercedes or a Maserati if he wanted to win races. But he never lost the love of being the underdog. And in a way, that was the key to that great Monaco victory. And later in the year, he won a similar victory on an equally demanding circuit, the Nürburgring, beating the Ferraris again, again as the underdog. And he'd come to enjoy that. You know, he got great satisfaction from beating what on the face of it was a superior team.
And of course, in 1962, in April, he has this horrendous crash. I mean, he'd already had a bad crash at Spa, hadn't he, before, and he'd had that mounted on the wall, I believe, in the steering wheel club, I think it was, perhaps.
Yes, he had a terrible crash at Spa in 1960 in a Lotus when it something broke, stub axle, and he went off the road and broke all sorts of things, vertebrae, both legs, all kinds of bits and pieces of himself. And he was back in the cockpit in 7 weeks, you know, having broken his back and his legs.
Yeah, and that was the meeting, of course, where two other British drivers were killed in the same race.
They were. I mean, motor racing really was dangerous in those days. Yes, that was Alan Stacey and Chris Bristow, two very, very promising young British drivers. Mm. But he managed to recover from that, and, you know, by the end of the season, he was back winning Grand Prix again. And in 1961, you know, he was absolutely at his peak. But then at the beginning of 62, he thought, well, maybe it's time, you know, to look at Ferrari again. And Ferrari had been making him offers all the way through his career. And they had a meeting at the beginning of the season. And Ferrari said, I'll give you a car. You can paint it in the colors of the man who's been entering your Lotuses, a friend of his called Rob Walker, whose cars are always painted blue. And, you know, you can use your mechanics and you can collaborate with our mechanics, and it can be more or less a works entry. We'll give you all the support. And while he was waiting for that, which, you know, he believed would give him a championship, since Ferrari had been so dominant the season before, he raced a Lotus, again an obsolete car, at Goodwood at the beginning of the season, before the Grand Prix season really got underway. And that's when he had the accident that finished it, his professional career, as it turned out. An accident for which no real explanation has been found. He went off the road at about 120 miles an hour, hit an earth bank at probably about 70, having gone across the grass, absolutely head on. And the car, they were very flimsy in those days. You know, they weren't, you know, nowadays drivers get out of cars in which they've done triple somersaults. Mm. You know, everything has been torn off the car, but there's a survival cell which keeps them alive. Well, there was nothing like that in 1962. And the car just crumpled around him, and it took 3/4 of an hour to cut him out of it. And he'd got broken limbs, but the worst thing was that his head had gone forward and hit the steering wheel around about his left eye. So his left eye socket was broken, and it had shaken up his brain very badly. So he was in a coma for more than a month. Came out of it eventually, recovered physically, but it took a long time for him to unscramble his senses. You know, his brain really had been knocked about, and it affected his memory. He didn't remember anything about the crash, anything about it at all. In fact, he only remembered leaving the hotel where he'd been staying to go to the circuit that morning. Didn't remember anything about the race meeting, and it left some holes in his longer-term memory as well. But eventually, a year later, he felt, you know, well, maybe I ought to try out a car and see if I might race again, because the papers had been, you know, for a year, the papers had been asking, you know, is Stirling Moss finished? When will he be coming back? So he went back to Goodwood a year after the accident with a sports racing Lotus, got into it, did laps for half an hour or so in a racing speed, and decided while he was doing that his brain and his hands and feet weren't coordinated in the same way that as they had been before the accident, that his instincts weren't quite as they had been. And when he got out of the car, he announced his retirement. And, well, that was very sad because he was, you know, he would still have been at his peak. He'd have had several years left to race at the top. And, in fact, a few months after that, he wondered whether he hadn't made that decision prematurely, that if he'd left it perhaps another year, then, you know, he might have recovered sufficiently to race at the very top level again. But he'd made his decision and he kept it.
I mean, the thing is, I mean, people talk about the accident, but, and, you know, did he, I mean, he was 32 when the accident happened, and motor racing then moved on very, very quickly indeed, you know, with the developments and whatever, and that new, I mean, just imagining Stirling at his peak in 64 when you had Surtees, Hill, Clark, all that sort of Stewart coming onto the scene as well would have been fascinating. But if you look back at the list of drivers in motorsport from the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s, and especially on this weekend, when we look and, you know, remember Ratzenberger today, and we'll be remembering Ayrton Senna's death tomorrow, and you think that on the back of a ticket or a press pass or whatever pass you have, it says motor racing is dangerous. And it would have been all too easy. And then we talk about Stirling, you know, who passed away last year at the age of 90. And, you know, had Stirling Moss come back and then being killed, you know, in a at Le Mans, or he'd been killed in a at Spa again, it would have been a terrible tragedy. And as it was, he certainly didn't fade into obscurity. I mean, his house, for example, and he was a recognised figure.
Yeah, he was. Once he'd retired, he went about the business of being Stirling Moss. You know, he had a very flourishing commercial career. He did things like opening petrol stations. You know, he did lots of endorsements and lots of public activities. He was great at all that. And, you know, so he kept himself in the public eye all the way through, you know, from his retirement at 32 almost up to his death at the age of 90. You know, everyone knew who Stirling Moss was.
I actually raced a Scalextric car against him in somewhere in the West Midlands in the mid-70s as a small schoolboy. That's my claim to fame with Stirling Moss.
Well, my equivalent of that is that at Goodwood, the Festival of Speed, about 20 years ago, they had a special press day.
Yeah.
And they were having a soapbox race that year, soapbox cars. And they'd had some special soapbox cars built, and there was a two-seater. And the idea was to race them, because, of course, they were propelled by gravity. The idea was to race them down the hill.
Yes.
At Goodwood, and I was given a ride by Stirling in this two-seater car, beautiful silver soapbox, little funny spindly thing on bicycle wheels. And it was amazing going down this hill between the straw bales, you know, next to Stirling Moss, feeling like Dennis Jenkinson in the Mille Miglia in 1955.
And of course,
you know, he had a great gift for sharing his enthusiasm and his enjoyment of motor racing. You know, he had wonderful stories, very well-polished stories, and someone once said to him, "Don't you get bored of telling these stories to people?" And Stirling said, "No, because they ask me, and I always remember when I'm telling a story to somebody, I might have told it 1,000 times, but they're hearing it from me for the first time." I think that's just marvellous. You know, that says a great deal about who he was and how he treated people.
And, of course, in the beginning of the book describes how you basically gave Stirling his last trophy, and it shows how much that he was revered throughout the racing world, because this was a trophy from the Mille Miglia, no?
The Pescara Grand Prix.
The Pescara Grand Prix, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, Pescara, 1957, they were short of Formula One races because there had been the petrol crisis after the Suez business, and a lot of races had been cancelled. So they organized a race in Pescara on the Adriatic coast of Italy, on a 15-mile circuit of public roads up into the mountains and then down along the beach. Great race. And Stirling went there with his Van Wall team, an English team. And he beat Fangio in the Maserati and the Ferrari, and it was the first victory in a World Championship Grand Prix for an English car and driver over the Italians. So it was a great victory. And 60 years later, they were having an anniversary event in Pescara, the anniversary of this great occasion, and I'd written a book about that race. And they asked me if I'd go over with Stirling and Lady Susie, Lady Moss, his wife, and accompany them. And they would be the guests of honor at this event in 2017. So, of course, I said yes, but delighted to. But then, sadly, 6 months before the event, Stirling fell ill. The illness that it took him out of the public eye completely. And so 3 months before, Susie said, "Well, he's not going to be able to make it." So the people in Pescara said, "Well, you come anyway, me, that is,
right,
and you can represent him." And, you know, so I went, and they treated me very nicely, and it was a wonderful thing. They had dinners and parades around the town of old car racing cars, and they'd... a vineyard had made bottles of special wine with Stirling's picture on the labels and that sort of thing. Anyway, they gave me a couple of bottles of the wine and a beautiful silver statuette of Stirling, which they'd been going to present to him to bring back to London. So I took it back and I took it to his house, and I felt, you know, that was Stirling's last trophy. And of course his house was full of trophies, you know, a lifetime of things that he'd won, including and his two bent steering wheels as well. So I added the last item, I think, to that.
And one of the great things about the book, The Boy, A Life in 60 Laps, is the fact that it brings, you've discovered things. And it's very, very readable because it's in very short chapters. So thank you for that, Richard. But it's because sometimes you get a history and it's, you know, 15 pages per tome sort of thing. But, you know, there's always something new and surprising to discover. And I think that that's what you did. And you've brought even more flesh to the bone, as it were.
Well, thank you. I mean, there are all sorts of things. I liked writing about his girlfriends, for instance, of whom there were very many. That was fun. And you know, his career was full of extraordinary things. He won the Tourist Trophy at Goodwood in 1960, for instance. He actually won the TT five times, but in 1960 he was driving a beautiful Ferrari 250 GT short wheelbase, which was essentially a road going car. And it had a radio in it. He won the 6-hour race, and he won it very convincingly. And, you know, he pretty early on, he built up such a lead, he switched the radio on. And the BBC was running a commentary. It was a Saturday afternoon, and the BBC on the light program, as it would have been then, was running Raymond Baxter's commentary on the race. So Stirling said I could listen to what was going on. He said I was getting pit signals about who was second and third, but I was interested in who was in the 1100 cc class and the 1500 cc class, how they were getting on. So I could I could hear that on the commentary.
If you like, Stirling Moss is the first pit lane radio that we've really ever had then.
Exactly. And I don't know anybody else who ever won, a world championship sports car race listening to the BBC.
The book is full of all these sort of things. The book is called The Boy, Stirling Moss, A Life in 60 Laps. It's made me smile. I urge you to go out and buy it and find it. It will be available as a download from the TRE virtual bookstore as well. It's by Richard Williams. Richard, if people want to find you, I know that you're active on Twitter. Where can they find you? And also, you have a website.
I do. I write about music as well. So the website is about music, and that's called thebluemoment.com. One word, thebluemoment.com. And what am I on Twitter? At rwilliams1947, I think.
You are indeed. You are indeed. This book is called The Boy, Stirling Moss, A Life in 60 Laps. It's by Richard Williams. Richard, as always, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you, Giles. Same here.